Shlavova Ki Jai. So this is May 14th, 2017, in New Vrindavan, West Virginia, and we're going to be looking at surrender. What is it? How do I do it? What do we mean by surrender? So we've divided this presentation into four parts. First part is going to be the story of the person who exemplifies surrender, Bali Maharaj. Then we're going to look at the six symptoms of surrender. These are explained differently in different places, slight differences. And I picked one explanation that I really find enlivening. Then we're going to look at the two of the 64 angas of bhakti, the 64 limbs of bhakti, that deal with surrender. One is Atmanivedanam, which is probably the Sanskrit term you think of when you think of surrender, which means making oneself the possession of the Lord. And the other is Sharanapati, which is acceptance of the Lord as one's protector. This is going to be a seminar, not a fun shop. You can take paper for this. Yeah. All right, everybody ready? Okay. First, we're going to go to the story of Bali, who's the personification or the epitome of surrender. So this story starts with Indra, the king of heaven. And Indra saw this big army coming towards him of Bali Maharaj. And he went to his guru and he said, "What should I do? The demons are coming to take over heaven." And his guru said, "Right now, the demons have won the favor of their own guru, Sukracharya, the favor of the Brahmanas, so you will not be able to defeat them. You'll have to defeat them later." So the demigods all took forms according to their own desires. So they probably took forms of like birds and animals. And they secretly went out the back door. So sometimes that's a good strategy. If you're way outnumbered by your enemy, just quietly retreat until it's the right time. I find it fascinating that when Krishna talks about the modes of material nature, one of the main differences between the mode of ignorance and the other modes is wrong time and wrong place. No, getting your timing right. You know, asking someone for a donation when they're taking a shower. That immediately puts it into charity and mode of ignorance. So Indra's mother, it's Mother's Day today, so Indra's mother didn't like the fact that her I want to just pause this seminar. All right. So Indra's mother was very concerned about her son. This is natural that if a mother feels that her children are at a disadvantage, that she will do almost anything to serve them. And this is true even among the animals. The bond between, especially mother and children in the animals, is stronger than the mating bond. You know, the mother will give up her life. Rukmini and I saw the other day when we were walking, one very small bird was vigorously attacking a larger bird and pushing it away. And I said, "I bet you that's a mother bird defending the nest." So she tells her husband, Kasyapa, "You know, I'm not happy. My children have lost their home. It's overcome by the demons." So he gave her a vow to do, and the Lord appeared to her, at which point she offered dandavats in ecstasy, and he said, "I'll become your son, and I will get back the kingdom for your other son, Indra." So then she had this son, Vamana. Vamana, which means dwarf or boy. So he appears just like a little non-threatening boy. So how interesting that God sometimes takes this form. Vaisheshika Kapu was talking about this today. Right? You ask for a penny and they may give you $50. So the Lord came in this very charming, non-threatening form. And the devas all gave him a variety of gifts. So meanwhile, Bali had been told that it wasn't enough to have conquered heaven, that in order to keep heaven under his possession, he would have to perform a number of yajñas. So he was performing one of these yajñas when little Vamandev, when the Supreme Lord, in the form of a little boy, walked toward the yajña. And it says he was pushing down the earth with his steps, although he was just a little boy. And he had such a great effulgence and beauty that all of the demigods there and the sages or whatever great personalities were there were all diminished in their own influence. So he came and as was the custom for the heads of government, even universal government, if a sage comes, they offer them charity. What would you like? Well, we have a little bit of this in our modern society, that governments fund schools with taxes. This conception that the government is supposed to give money for brahminical occupations is still there to some extent. So, and in other countries, the government often will give money to religions. In this country, we have that in the constitution. It's prohibited. So Bali said, oh, what would you like? You're a brahmana, what would you like? He said, you know, would you like a home? Would you like me to find you a nice wife? Would you like some gold? Would you like some cows? What would you like? And what did Vaman say? He said, I just want
three steps
according to my measurement. So if any of you have ever walked holding the hand of a little child, you know that you have to modify your own steps, right? Their stride is very small. So three steps, I mean, if we think about this, even if you took three of your own steps, you know, you'd barely have room for a bed, right? You'd hardly have a closet. You'd maybe have room to put a sleeping bag on the floor and put a little suitcase or something like that. And Bali Maharaj says to him, you're not very intelligent. He said, and this is the clincher here, he said, you should ask me for something so great, you'll never have to ask anyone else for anything ever.
Ooh.
Who's the only one who can say that? God. Only God can say, I can give you something so great, you'll never have to ask anybody else for anything ever. And especially when he said that, and Vamandev could understand, this really isn't the kind of mentality I want in somebody running the universe. Where they're thinking that they're God rather than that they're a servant of God. So he had two purposes. One was to get Indra back in charge, and the other was to rectify Bali. So at this point, Sukracharya, Bali's guru, he says, you better watch out here. Nobody asked for three paces of land. Something funny is going on here. And you know, he was very accomplished in Satvagun, and he could understand this is Vishnu in disguise. But it was predicated with this understanding, nobody else for three people, and it just isn't done. It made him suspicious. And he says to Bali, don't do it. Don't do it. Now people ask all the time, we had in the other seminars, people saying, my family doesn't support my Krishna consciousness. How do I make my family supportive? Well, maybe you don't. You know, great persons have to deal with opposition from families. Here he's having to deal with an opposition from his spiritual master. What to speak of opposition from family? And of course, even in Krishna Lila, there's opposition from family. The most exalted devotees, the gopis, have opposition from family. They even play like that in the spiritual world. Just imagine this. In the spiritual world, they're playing as if they have opposition from family. Isn't that fascinating? And we're thinking, let me get rid of all my opposition. So anyway, yeah, his guru opposed him. And his guru said, you know, if you're going to give charity, he'll take everything and you won't have anything left. And this is our fear. Just like that one young man was saying the other day, I'm afraid if I surrender to Krishna, I'll lose my friends. You know, I'll lose something. If I give everything to Krishna, well, what will I have for me? How will I live? Well, there's to be something that I need that I will lose and not get back. Yes? And this is what Sukracharya told Bali. He said, you give this to this little boy, you give him these three steps of land, you will lose everything. On the excuse of 3 steps of land, he'll take everything and you'll have nothing left. Now, who is he really worried about?
Himself.
Himself, because he was being maintained by Bali, as Bali's priest. And so if Bali lost all of his opulence, he wouldn't be maintained anymore. He didn't really care about Bali. The way you knew he didn't really care about Bali is then when Bali said, "But I already promised." And this is the mood of Kshatriya, somebody in government. My word. I will give up everything for the sake of my word. So I will be famous as a keeper of justice and morals and ethics. Now, the Brahmana will sacrifice anything for truth. The Vaishyas will sacrifice anything for wealth. The Kshatriyas will sacrifice anything for justice and morals and ethics and fame. So he said, I can't go back on my word. Better I be poverty-stricken, truthful, and righteous. It'd be nice to have some government people like that, wouldn't it? That would be quite a relief. So, how you could tell that Sukracharya didn't care, the guru didn't care about his disciple, was then really odd. He curses his disciple. Now, I'm sure none of you get angry, but I know when I get angry, I might say or do something that under normal conditions would be really dumb, and then afterwards you say, why did I say that? So Sukracharya got so angry that in his anger he said, if you give anything to this boy, I curse you to lose everything. But that was the whole thing he was trying to avoid. Did you ever think that was rather ironic? And I'm like, then you're going to lose either way, you know, it doesn't really make any sense. But this was the trick of Krishna. This is a kind of interesting sort of side note here, is that one of Krishna's qualities is that he's dependable, and that means if you follow the rules of the universe, you're going to get good results even if you're a demon. Krishna's fair. So Bali Maharaj had earned being in charge of heaven, although he wasn't the right person for the job, but he'd earned it. And he particularly earned it by his service to the Brahmanas. So Krishna's not going to just take away somebody's karma. Then nobody would, that wouldn't be the kind of world you'd want to be in, would it? You know, this is what a lot of religions say, that God will send you to hell if you just don't believe in him, no matter how good of a person you are. I mean, does anyone really want to serve a God like that, or be in the universe like that? So our conception is that, no, God rewards and punishes people appropriately. You wouldn't even have to think of it as rewards and punishment. Like I gave the example the other day. If you walk through the door, you're happy. You walk through the wall, you're not happy. And it doesn't matter whether you're an atheist or a theist. If you walk through walls, you'll not be happy. And if you walk through doors, you'll be happy. It's pretty simple. So if you follow the laws of the Lord, whether you believe in him or not, if you think the laws are just chemistry and physics and mathematics, well, you will get a good result. Yeah. So, what is Krishna going to do when an atheist, a demon, follows the rules and gets a position of power that they've earned? What is he going to do? He's not going to nullify the result of following the rules, because then nobody would follow the rules anymore. They'd say, oh, is this a bunch of nepotism? But what he's going to do is he's going to trick them to violate a higher principle. So a higher principle than good karma is how you treat saintly persons. That's operating on another level. It's a higher level. This is what the Lord also did with Hiranyakashipu. Gave him a Vaishnav son, and by offending his Vaishnav son, then the results of his austerities and karma could be nullified. So as soon as Bali gets cursed by a Brahmana, then all the other yajnas he did, all the other karma he did, becomes nullified. Because that's also a law of the universe. You've all followed that? So somehow Sukracharya was tricked in his anger to curse Bali. But Bali developed, when he saw Vamanadeva, this wasn't just some ordinary karma going on. He got in this mood that I'm going to give Vamana whatever he wants, no matter what the cost is to me. And we talked about this the other day, right? No matter what it costs. Not counting the cost. Not calculating the cost. So he does that. He says, all right. know, gives him water. And then, what does Vamana do? He expands himself to be the whole universe. And with two steps, he covers the universe to such an extent that he actually knocks a hole. Padanakanira Janita Janapavana. He actually knocks a hole in the covering of the universe. And then he says, all right, Mr. Truthful, Justice, Ethical, Moral person that you thought you were. You said three, you only gave me two. Liar. I just imagine this, okay? Maybe you don't have to imagine it. Maybe you've lived it. I gave everything to Krishna, everything unconditionally, and then all he did was... tied me up and humiliated me. Now, what did we say? Did we say, oh, what's this? I gave you my youth, I gave you my money, I gave you my energy, I gave you my house, I gave you my family, I gave you my intelligence, I gave you everything, and now I'm living it on the street, humiliated, everybody's criticizing me. Heck with you. I saw the other day a post from a devotee like this. He's just got very sick and he's in a lot of pain. He said, you know, I guess I'm not a very high priority on God's list. I made him a high priority. He didn't make me one. And Bali did not react this way. And even here, Prahlad Maharaj, as his grandfather, is coming and criticizing him. His own wife comes and criticizes him in front of everybody, including Lord Brahma. Just imagine. Hey, Bali. This is what you get for thinking that you can give somebody something so great that they never need to ask anything else of anyone else, ever. Bali's response at this point is further surrender. He doesn't back off. He doesn't say, wow, I shouldn't have surrendered. I was wrong to have surrendered. He surrenders more. He said, yes, you're right to tie me up. I was a liar. I was proud. You do need a third step. Okay, I'll give you that. Vamadeva said, you know what, now that you've surrendered everything, I'm going to give you a planet more opulent than Indra. And not only that, I'll stay there as your personal doorkeeper, I'll stay there with you all the time. And not only that, in a future millennium, you get to be the Indra legitimately. So, this is the way Krishna works. He comes and says, give me everything. We give him what we think is everything, and he says, no, you didn't really give me everything. Let's try this again. Now give me everything. And then if we really give everything, he turns around and he gives everything. So who gets more? If I give everything to Krishna and he gives everything to me, who gets more? I do. Okay, so how do we do this? What are the six symptoms of surrender? So as I mentioned, this is... Yes? That was from the Das Avatar. That's, we sing verse 4 of that every morning. Tavakarkam. So the six symptoms of surrender, sometimes one of them particularly is mentioned a little differently. So this is from Majjha 22.99, the way Prabhupada explains this. That's the next one. Okay, sorry, I'm one slide off. So here from Majjha 22.99, Prabhupada says there's two kinds of devotees. Those who are fully satiated and free from all material desires, and those who are fully surrendered to the lotus feet of the Lord. Their qualities are one and the same, but those who are fully surrendered to Krishna's lotus feet are qualified with this transcendental quality of surrender. So it's a higher level of devotee. And the six symptoms of surrender, this is Samajja 22.100. As I say, they're sometimes listed a little differently, and I particularly like this list. So you see that we've numbered it here? Yes? So we're going to be going through this section by section. So the first one is accepting things that are favorable to devotion. If something's favorable to devotion, I make it a part of my life. The next thing is rejecting anything that's not favorable to devotion. So the first one is, even if it's something that I like, that I don't like, I'll accept it. And the second one is, even if it's something that I like, if it's not favorable, I will reject it. In the third one, it's being convinced that Krishna will protect me. The fourth is that Krishna is my guardian or master, or that he will maintain me. The fifth one, and again, I really like this explanation in Majjha 2200, is having no separate interest, no independence in fulfilling one's desires. Now, it's always true that we have no independence in fulfilling our desires, but this is a conscious, deliberate awareness of that. Having my interest be one with the Lord, and the last one is humility. So we're going to look at these one at a time. So here's accepting things that are favorable. This means making those things a regular part of our life. If we can think about any relationship we have in this world, if we love somebody, then we make things a regular part of our life that are pleasing to that person that we love and that are favorable to the relationship. Does that make sense? Right? So, you know, if you're married, you want to make sure you spend some time with your spouse. People say, well, I'm married, but I'm just going to work all the time. Well, I'm giving money, that's enough. No, you have to have some time to nurture the relationship. You have to make an intentional time and space and activities to nurture the relationship. So I talk frequently about, I know it's Mother's Day and I'm talking about my father, but anyway, I talk frequently about how my father would get up early every morning, about 5:30, and he would spend 2 hours with me every morning. Even though he was the CEO of a multinational company, he was president of a temple, not a Hare Krishna temple, but so he was a temple president, he was a CEO of a big company, but he still gave me 2 hours every morning. And what that did was it really nurtured a relationship between my father and myself. And in 75 in Philadelphia, when we saw Srila Prabhupada, my father became a life member, and I got Gayatri Mantra, and Prabhupada said, good father, good daughter. But it wasn't just some automatic thing. It wasn't just the genes, you know. It was that we actually had a relationship. So this accepting things that are favorable means I make the things that are favorable to my relationship with Krishna a part of my life. So we're going to look at the five most potent items of devotional service as mentioned by Srila Rupa Goswami. So he lists 64 angas of bhakti. Yes, which apply to body, mind, and words. By the way, what does he say is the most important of the 64?
Accepting a guru.
Render service, getting initiated. So he puts guru as the most important. At the same time, he puts five as the most powerful. That anyone, even a little association with those things, can attain Krishna consciousness. So certainly these five are things we should be accepting in our life. So the first is worship of the deity. And this means to participate in the deity worship at a local temple, if that is possible geographically, if we can do that regularly, or at least as much as we can. And if you're not in close enough proximity to a temple, you have your own deity worship. And deity worship means, I know this is really radical, but it means something you do every day. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this this morning. You know, that we shouldn't have neglected deities as if we're just professional brahmanas. That when you have deities, it means that you take care of them. Just like if you have children. You know, you're not going to say, well, I'm going to dress you once a month. You know, change your clothes. Visit one devotee's house, and she said, well, we change the deity's cloth 4 times a year. You know, at the equinoxes and the solstices. And you give them something to eat, and you clean their place, and so forth. You actually take care of them. And you take care of them with the mood that here is God. Here is God. Or if you had a guest in your house, right? You have a guest in your house, you give them clean sheets and clean towels and you clean the place and make sure they have something to eat every day, right? They have some facility to clean their clothes and you take care of them. So Krishna is not just the guest, he's the master. So if we want to say that my house belongs to God, like tilak means my body belongs to God, so my house belongs to God, that then I have the deity, or at least a picture, some sacred space where I actively, in a very tangible way, it's not just theoretical, yeah, my house belongs to God. You know? But I demonstrate that in my daily behavior. Did we lose our sound? Why did we not get done with this? Oh, there we go. Okay, so the next one is holy places. So this means, of course, going to holy places in India, but it also means this place. New Vrindavan is also a holy place. It's a holy place because Srila Prabhupada came here, and it's a holy place because Krishna himself is here. Whenever there is Krishna, there is Krishna's abode. Guess where else is a holy place? Our heart. Right? When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was speaking to Amoga, who'd been blaspheming, he said, why have you made your heart such a dirty place where Krishna can't sit down? Right? They're doing some construction in a room next to the temple. So one morning I went in there to think I would chant, and but the chairs were all covered with construction dust. Right? You don't want to sit. Or when I was walking here, I saw the peacock Omkar, you know, the white peacock. So he was perched on the bench right next to the swan boat house. And the way he was perched was his tail was over the sitting part of the bench. What is that? Oh, so maybe I should turn that off. How could I do that?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm sure you all know what this is a picture of. This is what? Lust, anger, and greed. Lust, anger, and greed. Trividam narakashe dam dharma nasana matmana kama krodas tata lobas tasmat etwat tvayam twajet. So I recently read twice, actually, a book written by a Christian about anger. And he calls this book Unoffendable. And he's saying that most Christians feel that there's righteous anger that justifies them to defend themselves whenever they're insulted. Bless you again. Good cheap way to get blessings, right? You know, I'm really thinking about this. If we want to do the Trinadapi principle, then we have to be unoffendable. Now, we can't be getting angry every time we're insulted or offended. The way the world is we're constantly being offended. Now, we cannot hold on to our anger may come, but we shouldn't harbor anger. You know, harbor, a place where the boat comes in and you tie it up. You know, why do we harbor anger? Do you know why we harbor anger? Anybody have any idea why we hold on to anger? I bet you Sukkotma knows. Why do we harbor anger?
Because we've stuffed down our needs and held on to resentment and haven't dealt with it. And then it just keeps coming up and flowing until we actually wake up and we got to do something about it.
Okay, very good. I hope you hear what she said, that anger is a symptom that we're not dealing properly with our needs, that we're just suppressing stuff. Right? Any other reasons that we harbor anger? Yes,
Ruby. When we feel self-righteous, then we feel superior to other people, and that's a kind of angry joy.
Yes, yes, that's the material perversion of the anger rasa, that if I let go of my anger, it would prove that I wasn't right. You know? And I wouldn't be right anymore. I have to keep being angry at this to prove that I'm right. And we often talk about emotions like that too, you know. Well, you have no reason to fill in the blank. Well, I can be angry if I have a reason to be angry. If I give up my anger, that means I had no reason to be angry. That's not the way we're supposed to function. We're supposed to function that we see anger just as a signal, like you're talking about. Oh, there's anger coming. Oh, that's a signal that there's something I have to attend to. So let me go attend to it. But I neither harbor the anger nor do I try to destroy it. And the same with lust and the same with greed. If we harbor these, if we make excuses for them, if we nourish them, we will not have a relationship with Krishna. We won't even be a nice person for a relationship with other humans. We won't even be a very nice person for a relationship with ourselves. And this lust, anger, and greed, when we harbor them, when we nurture them, they have physiological effects also. They damage us physiologically, actually contribute to illness and things like that. So these must be given up. Lust, anger, and greed must be given up. It doesn't mean repression and suppression and destruction. It means realizing I'm the observer, neither grabbing nor destroying. Observing. Oh, there's feelings of lust, there's feelings of anger, there's feelings of greed entering my body and mind. Let me observe. Okay, that's a signal. What do I need to do? Let me do that. And then the feelings will leave. If you try to smash them, dash them, bash them, they're something like the old cartoon characters I used to watch when I was a child. They get smashed and dashed and bashed and they bounce back up. Yes? Remember those? I don't remember which cartoons they were. Roadrunner, I guess, and they're running into the wall, and, go, and they just bounce back up.
Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. So if you've ever tried smashing, dashing, bashing these things, you know that they just seem to come back again stronger. So that's not what we mean by getting rid of them. Nor should one say, well, it's been so hard to get rid of them, I'll just dance with them. Too hard. So neither. One must understand I am the observer, and these emotions and desires are symptoms. They're symptoms of the workings of the modes of nature. They're symptoms of things I have to attend to, but I do not have to get into them either positively or negatively. Then Srila Prabhupada, in the vows he gave us as disciples, gave us four things that we needed to give up. And he picked these four things because they particularly epitomize Kali Yuga. And if we get involved in these things, we will again find it very difficult to have a relationship with Krishna. It will be almost impossible. So the first is intoxication. And I'm sure as you've noticed that in pretty much every culture of the world, there is some sort of acceptable intoxication. Right? Because it's pretty hard to be a human being and not be spiritual. It's pretty tough. You're a human being, you're not spiritual. You really feel that you're suffering. And then, of course, meat eating. You know, it's just not possible to ask for mercy from God if we're not merciful to other living beings. And then gambling. This poor guy's about to lose his car. Gambling is, I think, I'm going to make money without offering any goods or services in return. I'm going to have a cheap, easy way of making money. And illicit sex. Took me a long time to try to find an illustration for this one. So, it destabilizes society, illicit sex. It basically destroys the fiber of society, and it gets us into an exploitive mentality. So, lust, anger, greed, intoxication, meat-eating, gambling, and illicit sex plunge us into darkness. Choice of music. All right, wait till you hear the next one. Seeing Krishna as our only shelter. I hope you didn't mind that. Trying to do a little yukta vairagya here. So being convinced that only Krishna can give us protection. You know, who do we think is going to give us protection? We think, well, my body's going to protect me. You know, I'll be really healthy. I'll eat lots of kale and smoothies. And, you know, my body will protect me. My mind will protect me. I'll get a lot of education, right? I'll have a lot of talents. My mind will protect me. Other people will protect me. My family, they'll always give me a place to stay. They'll give me money if I'm broke. Right, they'll always love me. My friends, they'll take care of me. Maybe other living beings, my dog, my cow, my goat, you know, or my things, my computer, that will protect me. My phone, you know, my country. My country will protect me. My government will protect me. So I don't think any of those are very reliable shelters, are they? No. But Krishna is a reliable shelter. Now, it's explained very nicely, this is in Bhagavatam 1:16, 26-30, that unsurrendered souls who are not devotees of the Lord have no particular protection from the Lord. So this protection offered by the Lord is not for people in general. The Lord says surrendering unto Him is the guarantee of protection. And this is true in general. I'm going to take care of people who become dependent on me for care. I'm not just going to take care of everybody. So we have a very nice song here. Bhaktivinoda wrote songs in the Sharanagati about each of the items of surrender. And we don't have time today to get into all of them, but I really highly recommend that you go through the Sharanagati if you're interested in this topic and learn some of his songs. Amala Bhakta now Maharaj has made recordings in English of all of the Sharanagati. And that's also, I find, a wonderful audiobook to listen to. So this is one of my favorites. Agnidev Prabhu just recorded this song in Sanskrit on his new CD. Bhaktivinoda says, surrendering my soul unto you has lifted from me the burden of false pride. No longer will I try to provide for my own safety. I know that you will give protection to your cherished possessions. O Lord, I now understand the mentality of your treasured cows safely maintained by your side. When you lead your herds to pasture, O Madhava, on the banks of the Yamuna River, you will call to them by softly playing on your flute. Fearless and confident of your protection, I will drink the water of the Yamuna. The Kaliya's serpent's venom poisoned the Yamuna's waters, yet that poison will be vanquished. You will purify the Yamuna, and by such heroic deeds enhance our faith. Bhaktivinoda is now the property of Gokula, your holy abode. O Keshava, kindly protect him with gentle, loving care. So we're now going to listen to an English, of this song sung in English. If you want to hear it in Sanskrit, it is on Adi Dev's CD.
Hey, go.
being able to sing some of these songs from Sharanagati on a regular basis, to study them, to listen to them, to meditate on them. I really like this song because Bhaktivinoda is identifying himself with Krishna's cows. I know that Bhaktivinoda is a Manjari Gopi, but in this particular song, he has this mood, Krishna's taking care of me just like I'm one of his cows. Okay, so we're going on to the next one. This is here seeing Krishna as the maintainer and the master. That Krishna's the one maintaining me. He's the one, before was the one protecting me, and here is the one that Krishna's maintaining. We tend to think that we maintain ourselves. You know, I have my job, I have my business, I have whatever, you know, I'm getting money from my parents or whatever. You know, we think I'm taking care of myself. But actually it's not a fact, because we all know that so many things can happen whereby we lose the ability to take care of ourselves. And even the ability we're having to take care of ourselves right now is coming from Krishna. Now, there's a really interesting take on this particular symptom of surrender. We're here in a lecture that Prabhupada gives on the Ishopanishad 1970, verses mantras 2 to 4. He says there are six phases of surrender. The first thing is that we should accept which is favorable for devotional service. We shall reject anything which is unfavorable to devotional service. And the next is that to introduce oneself to the associates of the Lord. Just like Krishna has got so many associates, you can, that will of course not artificially. When you are advanced to understand what is your relationship with Krishna, then if you introduce yourself with that association. So here Srila Prabhupada is giving a higher level of this symptom of surrender, of the Krishna's maintaining me, where you become part of a group that as we spiritually advance and we understand our eternal relationship with Krishna, then we become part of a group of cowherd boys, a group of cows, a group of cowherd girls, and so forth. And we have a sense that it's that group of eternal devotees that is maintaining our devotion to Krishna. So Bhaktivinoda has a very nice song on this Krishna maintaining me. He says, within my mind, I've always been anxious for the maintenance of my wife and children, my own body and relatives. How will I earn money and how will I acquire fame? How will I arrange the marriages of my sons and daughters? And how much energy are we spending into thinking about, or nowadays, I don't know, people don't have families anymore, so they're just thinking about how to maintain themselves. Now through self-surrender, I have been relieved of all anxiety. O Lord, surely you will provide for the maintenance of your own household. Recognizing me as your own servant, you will certainly maintain me. While rendering devotional service unto you, I feel the highest happiness. So he's feeling, I don't need to worry, I'll be taken care of. We talked about this a little bit, I think, yesterday. That, you know, if you work for a really good company, you can get absorbed in your work for the company and you don't have to worry about your paycheck. Isn't that a fact? You know, if it's a really good organization, or if you just know they're going to take care of you. If there's good parents, the children don't have to worry, am I going to eat? Am I going to get shoes? So we have this mood, Krishna is maintaining me. We still do our duty, but we do it as a service. And your service may be to have a job or whatever, but you're not thinking, that's what's maintaining me. I'm doing this as a service, and Krishna's maintaining me. Okay, the next one. This, again, I like to go back to that definition in Mudra 22.100, that self-surrender means remembering that one's activities and desires are not independent. That we're dependent on Krishna, and the devotee acts and thinks as Krishna's desires. A devotee is always conscious he's not independent in fulfilling his desires. Unless Krishna fulfills them, they cannot be fulfilled. So this is a mood of self-surrender. Whatever my desires are, whatever I want to accomplish, I always go to Krishna. Even for material desires, I go to Krishna. It's not that I go to Krishna, let me serve you, and then for other things I want, I try to do them myself. Even if I want something in this world that's not absolutely necessary for service, I can go to Krishna and say, Krishna, I would like this thing. You know, if you want. If you want. If you don't want, that's okay. You know, very nice. This is one very famous book about man-woman relationships. And the author suggests that if the wife is asking her husband for something and he says no, she should just respond with, okay. And I thought that's how we have to be with Krishna, you know. We go to Krishna and we say, Krishna, I'd really like this. And sometimes he says no, and then I'm like, okay. And I know I'm dependent on you. If you want to give me this, you give me this. Whatever my desires are, whether it's a desire for service, you know. I mean, just even little things. There was one Sunday feast here where after the Sunday feast I was thinking, you know, I'm still hungry. But I don't really want to eat more of what's there. You ever felt like that? You're hungry, you want to eat more of what's there? And I thought I didn't bring any money to go to the restaurant. So, oh well. And I was thinking like that, and then immediately Dara walks up with a whole container of cheesecake. And she says, here, Romila, would you like a piece of cheesecake? Isn't that fun when that happens? So, it doesn't happen all the time, but when it happens, you're like, thanks. So we know we're not independent in fulfilling our desires, whatever they may be, whether it's, you know, I'm hungry, or, you know, I want a nice kid, or whether, you know, I really want to fall in love with you and I really want to serve you. We know that we're dependent. We don't go independently. So Bhaktivinoda has a nice song for this item of surrender. He says, the soul inhabiting this mortal body has given up the false ego attached to the word I. For today, the spiritual sense of being yours has entered his heart. All my possessions, body, home, servants, brothers, friends, wives, sons, personal belongings, fencing and gateways, that's why I have a gateway here. All of these are now yours, for I have become your servant. I am but a mere occupant in your house. And this is one of the functions of deity worship. You have the deity in your house, and it's the deity's house. And I am a servant in the deity's house. I am a servant in Krishna's house. You are the owner of the house, and I am your most obedient servant. My only activity now is endeavoring for your happiness. My will has become merged with your will. From this day forward, Bhaktivinoda has completely forgotten himself. Now, again, this is not repression. How can you forget yourself? Well, first of all, we're part of Krishna. So if I'm working for Krishna, I am included. And I don't have to think about myself separately. I'm already included. Naturally. And Krishna is so satisfying. Again, like if you work for a very responsible company or whatever organization, you only have to think about their happiness. You just have to think about the mission of the organization, the mission of the company, and they're going to give you a desk and a computer and a phone and a salary and vacation times and everything. Now, generally in this world, that doesn't happen perfectly. You may still have to go and say, hey, can I get a raise? Can I get a vacation? But you can imagine the concept. So we forget about our self-interest because we can. It's not that I'm going to repress all of my own self-interest. And he goes on in this song, I have become supremely happy by surrendering myself at your lotus feet. Sorrow has gone far away, and there are no more cares. All I see is joy in the four directions. Okay, now the last one is humility. So here we see Maharaj Pataparudra sweeping the road in front of Jagannath, and Krishna taking a humble position, washing the feet of Sudama Brahmana. This is Uddhava. Bhaktivinoda's song. Now please hear me, O Lord, I am utterly helpless. Bhaktivinoda says, without your mercy, everything is lost. Please give me the shelter of your lotus feet. I drank the deadly poison of worldliness, pretending it was nectar. And now the sun is setting on the horizon of my life. Were you to judge me now, you would find no good qualities. Have mercy and judge me not. Cause me to drink the honey of your lotus feet. So these are the six symptoms of surrender. Now we're going to look at the two limbs of bhakti, that deal with surrender. And you're going to notice how the six symptoms of surrender are included in these two limbs of bhakti. These are Atmanivedanam and Sharanapati. So the distinction between them is a little subtle, and I would say there's a little overlap. Atmanivedanam is I am the possession of the Lord. I am yours. The perfection of the I. And Sharanapati is I'm accepting the Lord as my protector. And I see it's a little different. I can belong to you but not feel that you're my protector. I can belong to you in a different capacity than being protected by you. So the Atmanivedanam is I belong to you, and Sharanapati is you are my protector. And again, the six symptoms of surrender are included in these two. Is that clear to everybody? So you have two practices of bhakti, and in these two practices of bhakti, you'll find the six symptoms of surrender, which is what we just discussed. Yes? Okay, good. I hadn't planned to use it. We're going to go into more detail. Atma Vedanam, and you have Sharanapati, and then you have the six symptoms of surrender. Anybody remember what they are? Accepting what's favorable. And the next is rejecting unfavorable. Next. Lord is protector. Next. Lord is maintainer. Next. No separate what? No separate interest. Feeling we're not independent in fulfilling desires. And six is?
Humility.
So these are part of these two. And so this one is the Lord is protector. And this is I am the Lord's. So this is a sense that I belong to the Lord. This is a sense that the Lord will protect me. We're going to go into these in a little bit more depth. And you can see, you know, definitely this is a prominent symptom here, and this is going to be a prominent symptom here. Does that make sense? This is going to be a prominent symptom here. So the different six symptoms of surrender are going to be more or less prominent in each of those two categories of surrender. Okay, we're going to look at each of these. They shorten my time for this class. I'm going to look at each of these in a little bit of depth. So Atmanivedanam is considering ourselves the possession of the Lord, basically offering everything to the Lord. Whatever I have belongs to the Lord. So in Bhagavatam 11:29-34, it says a person who gives up all fruit of activities and offers himself entirely unto the Lord, eagerly desiring to render service unto him, achieves liberation from birth and death, and is promoted to the status of sharing the opulences with the Lord. So Krishna says, I take charge of your life. When you're someone's possession, they're taking charge of you. As soon as a person surrenders to Krishna, then Krishna immediately frees them from sinful reactions and takes care of them. Now this I really like, where Prabhupada makes this point that all of us help and instruct our own people, isn't it? You may not go up, hopefully, you don't go up to just strangers on the street and give them advice, I hope. But among your own family and intimate friends, You're going to help them probably when they solicit your advice and maybe even when they don't. If they're your own people, you're going to help them. So as soon as I become Krishna's own person, he will guide me. Does that make sense? He will take, oh, you're mine? Okay, let me give you proper advice. Now, this I am Krishna's, this I, Atma Nivedana, who's the I, who's the Atma? And that can be understood as the mind, the body, and the soul. So the body, I'm surrendering my body. See, sometimes people think Atma Nivedana means just body or just mind or just soul. So body means that just like you don't worry about an animal that you sold to somebody else. Now you had a dog and you had to move and the place you were moving to couldn't have a dog anymore. You're moving from the country to the city. So you sell the dog to somebody else. You find a good owner, and then you don't worry about them anymore. They're not your dog. So we give our body to Krishna. Isn't that cool? It's already his. It's already his. So we're not really giving it to him. It's already his. But we're acknowledging it's yours. Does that mean we don't take care of our body? We take care of our body as a service. Not that I'm the one taking care of the body. Imagine that you had a car and you gave the car to the temple. It wasn't your car anymore. But the temple president might say, or the temple commander, please change the oil in the car. So you're not going to say, I'm not going to change the oil in the car. It isn't my car anymore. I gave it to you. You change the oil. The renunciate Maya is that it belongs to nobody. And the householder Maya is it belongs to me. Right? The renunciate Maya is no one's going to change the oil because it's not my car. And the householder car is, I will change the oil because it's my car. And so, let me give my body to Krishna and then let me give my body exercise and proper diet out of service to Krishna. And that's true not only for our bodies, but the body of any family members we're taking care of. Because he's offered his body to the Lord, he gives up all activities for pleasure in this life and the next, which nourish his body and things related to his body. The Lord then thinks, oh, I desire to make him special. The devotee then attains freedom from death and attains similarity to Krishna. This means that the devotee attains liberation in the form of attaining his swarup, his original form, and sharsti, his powers like those of the Lord. And then what about mind? Mind is, I'm always thinking about Krishna, and everything I do is dedicated to him. My mind, my household affairs, my body, whatever is in my possession, my dear Lord, I offer to your service. Now you can do whatever you like with me. But we should fill our mind with Krishna. How do we surrender our soul to Krishna? Oh, this is probably the scariest slide of all. Sri Yamunacharya, in his prayers to the Lord, has expressed an idea in the following words. My dear Lord, I may be living within some body as a human being or as a demigod, but whatever mode of life, I do not mind. Because these bodies are simply byproducts of the three modes of material nature, and I, who am in possession of these bodies, am surrendering myself to you. Surrendering my soul means you can put me in the soul wherever you like. I told you that was the heavens. Completely to the will of the Lord. Surrendering to the Lord doesn't mean a merchant. Okay, I surrender to you. Where's the money? Where's the house? Where's it? You know, where's all the stuff? It means I surrender. You can do whatever you like with me. You can kill me. You can save me. You can make me poor. You can make me rich. You can make me sick. You can make me healthy. You can make everybody love me. You can have everybody hate me. You can use me as a great example, and you can even use me as a bad example, like happened with Mars Yudhisthira, the gambling manager. Those devotees said, Lord, if you need somebody to be a bad example, I'll do that. People will criticize. We're criticizing Yudhisthira still 5,000 years later. But he's earned. That's my service, that's my service. Now, this Atmani Vedanam, as you can imagine, is very rare. And the reason it's rare, Rupa Goswami says, is because it's very difficult to do. It's not rare because it's only for advanced devotees. It's not rare because it's only for advanced devotees, Rupa Goswami says. It's rare because it's difficult and it's kind of scary. So it can be executed even by beginners. But Rupa Goswami gives two examples of where Atmani Vedanam is done by very advanced devotees, where it's mixed with an advanced bhava. One example he gives is of Maharaj Ambarish, who mixed self-surrender with the mood of dasya, with the mood of service. Where when we don't have, sorry, we don't have time to tell the whole story, we'll talk about very, very briefly, that the king had this guest, Durvasa Muni, who showed up right when it was time to break his fast. And he told Durvasa, you know, can I give you something to eat? And Durvasa said, I want to take a bath first. And he goes all the way to the river to take a bath. And meanwhile, the king is like, I got to break my fast. This is part of my worship of the Lord. I have to eat now. What am I going to do if I eat before my guest? I'm violating etiquette, but if I don't eat, I'm not going to please Krishna. All right, I'll drink a little water. Because he had fasted from food and water for a day. I'll drink a little water, that'll break my fast, but it won't be violating the etiquette. And Durvasa comes back, and by his mystic power, he says, you drank water before me! Die! That's what he did, actually. Imagine that. I mean, I've had some difficult guests, you know, but not quite like that. And so he just, with his mystic power, he creates this demon to kill the king, and the king's just... Okay. Now, as a king, by the way, he wouldn't have acted like this if he was in the middle of a war. You know, if he was out on the battlefield, he wouldn't have just said to the enemy, okay, kill me if you like. But because this was a guest and a brahmana, he said, okay, if Krishna wants to kill me, that's fine. If it's my time to go, it's my time to go. And Krishna said, no, not your time to go. And he sent the Sudarshan Chakra to defend him. So this is this full surrender to the will of the Lord mixed with the mood of dasya, or servantship. Then Rukmini mixed Atmani Vedanam with the romantic mood when she wrote to Krishna and said, my brother is arranging for me to get married to this really nasty guy who I don't like. He's trying to force me into this marriage. I don't want to get married to this guy, but he set the wedding date for tomorrow. That's the best heroism, right? When you save the damsel in distress at the last minute. He said, so please, you kidnap me. Because my father's agreed, the whole family's against me. Kidnap me and marry me. But she surrendered. And she said, if you won't take me, then I'll do austerities lifetime after lifetime until somehow your other... you married me. Of course, she was also very surrendered when Krishna was teasing her. Right? She just surrendered. Okay, the next one, Sharanagati, which is feeling that the Lord is my protector. So this is with faith and protection of our body, mind, and words. Such a person can actually relish transcendental bliss. That we have a sense the Lord is protecting my body, He is protecting my speech, and He is protecting my mind. Of course, the exemplar here is Nisingadev, and in Nisinga Purana he says, anyone who prays unto me and takes shelter of me becomes my ward, and I protect him always from all kinds of calamities. Of course, again, this is a surrender, this is not bargaining. So it's Krishna, you protect me how and when you like. Surrender doesn't mean that we demand something of the Lord. Sudama Vipra was very poor and sickly. And when he went to see Krishna, he didn't say, okay, I want this, I want this, I want this. Surrender means, Lord, I know you're going to protect me, and I am happy and satisfied with however you protect me. If you feel I'm protected more in poverty than in wealth, then I accept that. So what we went over today... we discussed the story of Bali Maharaj, how he personifies or epitomizes surrender, the six symptoms of surrender, and Atmani Vedanam, and Sharanagati as the limb, the two limbs of bhakti that include the sixth sentence.
Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vaja aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshayishya.
Thank you very much. It is now 11:58, and we were originally able to go to 12:15, and then Jai Krishna Guru said we were supposed to end at 12. If anyone has just a quick question. Yes, Prabhu. Do we have a mic person that can run?
I have a question. Earlier you were talking about anger, lust, and greed.
Yes.
And is envy related to anger, or is envy a result of anger, or does anger come out of envy, or is there any relationship at all between envy and anger?
Well, there's some relationship between all of those enemies. You know, lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, madness. They all have some relationship to one another. It is interesting that although Krishna describes a whole list of demoniac qualities, that he hones in on lust, anger, and greed as the ones really to get to. You know, those are the three he hits on and says, okay, there's all these demoniac qualities, and you're thinking, oh my, what am I going to do? This long, long list. So these three, we've really got to take care of. Envy is basically the feeling that nobody should be as good or better than me. You know, you can have a nice car as long as it isn't as nice as mine. And then you can, your kid can get honors and rewards as long as my kid gets more. Something I ran into as a teacher all the time. You know, you can have an accomplished, attractive spouse as long as mine is more so. And you can certainly see how that would... You can certainly see how that would lead to anger. I mean, the story that I sometimes tell about my own experience with envy was I had a student who was from Nepal, and he gave me a chadar, a beautiful multicolored chadar, and he said, my mother sent this from Nepal for you. I thought, oh, they think I'm a wonderful teacher, and they're giving me this chadar as recognition of my wonderful teachingness. And I very proudly wore the chadar to Mangal Aarti the next morning. And I looked around, and every woman in the temple had the same chadar. and I was very angry. But the anger was stemming from envy. You know, how dare everybody else have an equal nice chadar to mine? I was definitely angry. I was angry at the student and his mother. I was so angry at everybody. She didn't understand about me. There's definitely a relationship. And there's a relationship with lust. I mean, Krishna talks about the relationship of lust to anger. Oh, and there's a relationship of lust to envy, when people have something that's equal to or greater than me, that I want what they have. So they definitely all have a relationship with each other. But Krishna says, hit these three and you'll knock out everything else. That's kind of interesting. Just get lust, anger, and greed. Now, sometimes we're told, if you just hit envy, you knock out everything. So sometimes we're told you just knock out pride. You know, in his Manashiksha, Ramadasa Swami is honing in on pride. You just knock out this thing and you knock everything else. And my understanding is they're all related. So because they're all related, there's many points at which you can hit it that you'll knock out the whole thing. And again, though, I really want to make the point that getting rid of lust, anger, and greed does not mean that we're getting an attack policy on those. It's not what it means. It's not the way we do it. It will not work. The way I find it fascinating, in Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, Krishna gives the fall-down sequence, contemplation to attachment to lust to anger. And then in 264, he talks about just being the detached observer. So, which is what we actually are. It's just realizing that. So the way I'm going to be free of lust, anger, and greed is neither accepting nor rejecting them. Neither. Just observing. Just the ocean, where the river is flowing to the ocean that doesn't overflow. Is that all right?
Greed is suggesting or...
Greed is what? Yes?
Greed is like, I want this, I want this.
No, it's that you're never satisfied. Lust is more, I want this, I want this. Lust is, I want and I don't care about the consequences. It's gone beyond attachment. Lust is like, I gave the example yesterday, like our former President Bill Clinton, where he has an affair with an intern, even though it's going to threaten his position as President of the United States. So if you think about that logically, it's absurd. Why would you threaten your position as President of the United States to have some liaison with an intern? You know, it's not... The cost-benefit ratio is really messed up there. But what it means is that you want something so badly that you become blinded by that. But lust doesn't just mean sexual lust. It can mean anything you want. And it can mean fame and ego thing. Anything you want so badly that you just disregard the consequences. You forget about the consequences. You don't think about the consequences. And you just, I'm going to go for that, and it doesn't matter what I have to pay for it. That's basically lust. You become blinded. And greed is a sense of being not satisfied. It's kind of like, you know, lust on steroids. It just keeps going and going and going and going and going and going and going. You have three houses, and you need to have five houses. You understand? You know, you got $10 million in the bank, but you need to have $10 billion. It's just never enough. You never have enough pairs of shoes, and you never have enough awards, you never have enough degrees. I mean, I know some people are like that with learning. And they never do anything practical. They're just getting one degree after another. I mean, I know one devotee like that. It's constantly taking this and that course. Like, you've been taking courses for 20 years. Why don't you do something with them? And this is mentioned with the accumulation, not accumulating, over-accumulating. Is mentioned in the Nectar of Instruction. And it talks on the subtle level also. You know, and after that, I just have to get more and 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 more. So that, it says that lust and anger can at least be temporarily satisfied, but greed can never be satisfied. So that's one of the differences. At least temporarily, your anger is dissipated, your lust, you know, you get what you want, and you're okay, satisfied. Although they come up again. Is that okay? Anything else? Yes? What are hurt and depression symptoms of? Well, all of our emotions, both positive and negative. First of all, I know this sounds really weird, but we're trying to enjoy our emotions. Okay, they're rasas. So hurt and depression are what rasa?
Gasping?
No. Maybe a little bit of gasping. Could be. But it's mostly karuna ras. It's sadness. We're trying to enjoy sadness. We all enjoy sadness. You know, a lot of movies and books are sad, and people enjoy watching and reading something sad. So we can also enjoy our own sadness. So part of it is we're trying to enjoy something separate from Krishna. We're enjoying a sadness rasa that's me-centered instead of Krishna-centered. And the result of it is it's not very enjoyable. So, one thing that I found very, very helpful is just to look at Krishna, look at the deity, look at the picture of Krishna, and say, Krishna, I wish I had this intensity of emotion for you. And often I found, and many people tell me this also, that just saying that shifts everything. Just, Krishna, I wish I felt this intensity of emotion for you. Whatever it is, whether it's a so-called good emotion or a so-called bad emotion, whatever it may be, when we're overwhelmed by material emotions which are all me-centered, when we're trying to enjoy this me-centered rasa, if we just look, and especially the negative ones we tend to do this with because we want them to go away, So, of course, we don't really want them to go away. We're enjoying them. So if we look at Krishna, we say, Krishna, I wish I had this intensity of emotion for you. I find often just doing that is enough. Because it puts you right to the position of observer, and it puts you understanding what's the real rasa. That this actual sadness and depression, when should you feel depressed? When Krishna's being swallowed by Bakasura, you should be very depressed. It's depressing. When Krishna goes into Bakasura's mouth, that's pretty depressing. When Krishna goes to Mathura, sadness doesn't even, you can't even talk about it. I mean, they were sad and depressed beyond anything we can materially imagine. But it was all ecstatic. It wasn't some material depression. You know, and you can say, Krishna, I wish I felt this way about you, and then start meditating on how the residents of Vrindavan felt when Krishna was in Mathura. And he just sends a message, I'm coming. When are you coming? And why do they want Krishna to come? Because they knew that Krishna was happiest in Vrindavan. They're thinking, he's not really happy there in Mathura. I know he's not happy. It's really formal for him there. It's not what he likes. He likes the country atmosphere. He's going there because, you know, his family's there. But you know, I know he's not happy there. He needs to be here so we can make him happy and switch it to that. Now, another thing you can do is you can also look at emotions as some kind of a signal, just like a light lighting up on the dial of your car. So, you know, you're driving a car and the light turns up, engine needs work. So, hopefully you don't keep driving like that. You know, one time, anyway, I was driving back from having dental surgery. I'd had two wisdom teeth removed, and I was so stupid that I decided I was going to drive myself to and from the oral surgeon. Bad idea. Because I just got local anesthesia, and I thought, you know, I'll get back. I thought I'll pick up the pain prescription and get back home before the Novocaine wears off, and I have to take the pain medication. That was my idea. My car broke down, and I was stranded. So I was able to kind of limp into a gas station, and I called my husband. He couldn't come get me. He was stuck, and he couldn't come. And he said, how much is it going to cost to fix? And I said, oh, it's going to be over $1,000. And he said, you know, the car isn't worth that much. And then he said, look, this was really stupid on his part. I'm sorry if you're listening. But he said, just try to get home. Bad advice. So I take this car that didn't work, you know, and I'm trying to get home. And of course, you know, it breaks down on the side of the road. And then my whole face is swung on the marks. I'm telling this story, what did you have to do?
Emotions as a signal.
Emotions as a signal, yes. So I should have just understood, hey, you know, somebody needs to come pick me up. I need to get a friend or something. Right? You don't just ignore the thing on the car. It was flashing, engine trouble, engine trouble, engine trouble. You don't say, well, I'm just going to ignore that and keep driving. I mean, it was such a bad idea. Ignoring that, you know, like, God, Krishna. I was stranded in the middle of the highway and these two Muslim women in hijabs picked me up. They brought me to a gas station where I called a taxi. But it's the same way with our emotions. When our emotions are flashing, you know, engine trouble, engine trouble. Don't just try to keep driving. Don't just say, well, I'm just going to try to push through it. So ideally, take the position of the observer and offer to Krishna. But then you also have a service to take care of your body and mind. That's your service. So you look at it and say, okay, you know, I better go to the repair shop. You better take care of this. Maybe someone needs to give me a ride. Not going to just push through and end up broken down on the side of the road and have my face all swollen up and pain. I mean, I end up looking like a pooler in terrible pain. So, not a good policy. Yes, the last one.
You just said, how do you feel that emotion for Krishna when you know he's going to get out of it? You know he's going to get out of Agassura's mouth.
That's only if you're in Vaikuntha, you know that.
Good question.
He said, how do you feel emotion for Krishna if you know he's going to get out of it? I said, it's only Vaikuntha, they know he's going to get out of it. In Vrindavan, they're not sure. And anyway, look, I mean, I don't know, when I was a kid, I remember watching, like, Superman TV shows. Did you ever watch anything like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you know the guy was going to get out?
Yeah.
Of course he's going to get out. Otherwise, the whole TV show is canceled. You know, Superman is going to get out of the problem. Of course. Is it still exciting?
Yeah.
It's exciting to somebody. Somebody's paying their money to watch it. Maybe it's not exciting to you and me, but somebody's excited. So even though they know, they don't know how. How's he gonna get out of this one? I mean, I was never into Batman, but I remember at school, all my friends watched Batman every week. And they had the way they did it was 1 week, Batman would get into trouble, and that show would end with Batman in trouble. And the next week, Batman would get out of trouble and fix. I mean, I watched it once, and I said, this is a really stupid show, but people were talking about it all the time. And every other week, how's he going to get out of it? How's he going to get out of it? How's he going to get out of it? They were absorbed, even though they knew he would get out of it. So if we can get that absorbed about some fictional thing, that's a little tiny spark of Krishna's splendor, some invented thing, why can't we feel that way about Krishna? How's he going to get out of it? What's he going to do? What's he going to do? Bakasura is swallowing him up.
Oh.
Kali has wrapped him. He's stuck in that door. He can't get home. What's he going to do? What's he going to do? How's he going to figure it out? Come on, you can think like that with your own life. Look at your own problems and say, okay, how are you going to figure this one out? Let's wait and see how you untangle this one. Let him be your hero. Let Krishna be your protector and rejoice in the way that he rescues you. Krishna will not rescue you in conventional ways most of the time. It's just, he's not a like 40-year-old, it's not who he is. It's not like, okay, we have the rule book here. Devotee gets in this, this is our protocol. Okay, it's not what it is. It's raining. Okay, let's pick up a mountain. Is that like a normal protocol? Can you imagine the government doing that? You know, there's a flood. Okay. Activate, what is it, FEMA? Activate the emergency system. All right, what's our job? Pick up the mountains. Who's going to do that? So the way that Krishna rescues us may be really, really interesting. It may be really interesting. When we were trying to build the Gurukul in Detroit, so we actually had no money to make the last payment, and then we got this inheritance from a great aunt that we had no contact with ever. My husband said, I can't believe she gave us any money, and it was enough money to pay for the Gurukul, to pay the last payment, and there was some extra money, and he had that, and it was the end of the day, and he was just about to close up his shop, and a customer comes in, so he took that extra money. And he put it in the rafters because he was holding all this cash. And some customer was walking in. It was like 8:02 or something. He was about to close. And he thought, well, I don't want to stand here with all this money, especially in Detroit. So he like takes the envelope and he puts it up in the rafters. And he
forgets
about it.
Oh.
Completely. Completely, totally forgets about it. Absolutely. Totally. Years later. Years later, we were in financial difficulty. It was really, I mean, it was just like, you know, he said, we just had absolutely nothing. And he was starting to sell that house. He was starting to get that house ready for sale to try to make some money. We weren't living there anymore. So he was going through the whole house, like, inspecting it. And when he was downstairs, what is that little white corner?
Wow.
So Krishna has really funny ways. I mean, he's really humorous about this. It was as if he said, you don't need this money right now. I'm going to put it in a savings account. A non-interest savings account. I'm going to put this in a savings account. And right when you need it, I'm going to give it to you. And I've had these funny experiences. And most devotees I know have had these really funny experiences. You know, or some of the funniest ones was when Ravindra Srupadu tells this story. How there was no money to pay the rent at the temple. He was the treasurer. And he went to the temple president and said, we need $400 for the monthly rent or mortgage. And the temple president said, well, just go out on Sankirtan, which in those days meant going out in dhotis and saris, just chanting and selling back to God in magazines for 25 cents. So, you know, that's what they did, and they would collect the money in a conch shell, and so at the end of the Hari Nam, they probably collected, you know, $5 or $10. And so they're getting to go in the van to go back, and Ravindra Swarupuru sees on the other side of the street this very tall, blonde, very handsome young man, kind of looking around. And then he crosses the street and hands Ravindra Swarupuru an envelope that says, "For Krishna," and it has four $100 bills in it. You know? Or they really felt, I'll end with this one, the really funny story that Rameshwar Prabhu just told, which just, this is a little knock your socks off story. So Rameshwar Prabhu is in Los Angeles, it's a Sunday feast, and he's just talking to the guests, and there's this one gentleman, nicely dressed, like in his 30s, and he's talking about Krishna consciousness just like you talk anybody about Krishna consciousness. You're not this body, God is a person, you know, simple stuff. And he tells him, "We have this book, the Bhagavad Gita, why don't you get one?" Guy gets the Bhagavad Gita and leaves. Comes back 15 minutes later, it's 9 o'clock at night, and the devotees had already gone to their rooms, Rameshwar's on his room, and there's a knock on the door. It's the same guy. And the guy says, "You know, I'd like to give something to help you guys out." So Rameshwar says, "Sure." The guy gives him a big metal briefcase. And Rameshwar says to him, "You know, look, I'm a monk. Whatever you give, we're just going to use for the mission. We're not going to take anything for ourselves, whatever." And then the guy leaves. Rameshwar never saw him. What's really funny is he doesn't even bother opening this briefcase for an hour. He just kind of puts it on the side. He's doing other things. Gets to be 10 o'clock at night. He opens the briefcase. It was $250,000 in cash in this briefcase. So he calls up another devotee, wakes him up in the middle of the night, you know, 10 o'clock at night, says, "You better get over here right now." So the other devotee comes, and they're talking about it, and Rameshwar was so BBT trustee, and they decided, this is really interesting to me, they decided they were going to give it all to the BBT. They just decided that on their own. They didn't talk to them, they didn't give anything to the temple. And they didn't keep anything for themselves. If you think about this, if someone handed you $250,000, which in today's money would be probably double that in value, you know, at 9 o'clock at night, nobody else saw you, you know, you might pull out $10,000 for yourself. A lot of people, I think, would do that. They didn't do that. And the next morning, first thing in the morning, they go to the bank, and they deposit all of it in the BBT account, the whole amount. Then Rameshwar immediately calls up their publisher and says, "I want to print 10 million Bhagavad Gitas." And the publisher said, "No one has ever done a print run of 10 million, of that many books." I can't remember if it was 1 million or 10 million. He was telling me. So it's never been done before. He said, "To do this, we're going to have to backburner all of our other projects so we can make every single printing press available." And then they called a press conference to announce that this was a landmark in print history. So they had a whole big press conference, and that day they signed the contract that they were going to do this. Okay, so then it was like, that was on a Sunday, so it was on Thursday, that this big fancy car pulls up at the temple, and a bunch of guys get out in suits, all, you know, again, well-dressed, 30s, 40s, 50s, and they're looking for Rameshwar. And they go and find Rameshwar and said, "A friend of ours gave you some money the other day, but it wasn't really his to give." And we went back. And Rameshwar says, "Well, I've already spent all of it." And they didn't believe him. And you know, they were really incredulous. And then he took out the receipt from the printer, because he already arranged everything that Monday morning. Wow. So he took out the receipt from the printer and showed them it was all used for printing one book. One book. Biggest print run in history, and he shows them the Bhagavad Gita. I'm sure he gave them Bhagavad Gita. Never saw them again. That was the end of that. And then, of course, he told Prabhupada, who was, you know, over the moon with happiness. But, you know, Krishna has his funny ways. He has his funny ways, you know. He has his funny ways of solving problems, whether they're for the residents of Vrindavan or in our own lives. How Krishna acts is very humorous. And so therefore, we can, you know, how's Krishna going to solve this problem? How is he going to solve that problem? What is he going to do about this? What is he going to do about that? And we can have some, it's not just like, yeah, you know, he's gone. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.